The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. No, it isn't the Q&A. I'm delirious. It's actually the EDU show. So there's live podcasting for you right there. We're not going to edit that out. I'm sure everyone will understand. So today we're going to expand on the topic we started last week on the EDU show, as this is another EDU show. And that being the minimum dignity floor concept that we embrace here as our one of the fundamentals of our approach to retirement planning. We spent a lot of time last show describing the five key categories within the minimum dignity floor, what it represents, that being that base level of expenses that you must cover no matter what, no matter how long you live, whether you have assets or not, in order to maintain your established level of dignified living, thus the phrase minimum dignity floor. And we didn't get quite into all the nuances of the minimum dignity floor and how one might look at covering the minimum dignity floor. And that's where we're going to go today. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the other items or intricacies, I guess, when dealing with the minimum dignity floor. If you take our approach, you'll want to know kind of the implementation and use of the information once you've established your own minimum dignity floor, if you're out there in do-it-yourself land putting this stuff together. But I've got Jim with me here in studio, if you will. And I believe he's gotten a couple of questions that came up as a result of our show last week. I'm sure we'll get to those today. But he kind of left us with a cliffhanger last week where we were going to talk a bit about the variability of the minimum dignity floor. We're not going to go into all the details. If you want to review that show before you listen to this one, probably a good idea, where we go into all the details of the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare categories of that make up the minimum dignity floor and where we go to get those estimates, if you will, how we apply inflation and the like. But something we didn't hit last time is those expenses are just estimates over time. And in real life, these expenses are going to vary every year. You're not going to spend exactly the same amount on housing each year. Food is probably the most consistent of those. Insurance payments would be pretty consistent, but transportation expenses are going to vary depending on how much you have to fix your car or how much you drive that year. If you go on a long road trip or something, it's going to be different than on another year. You'll have healthcare expenses that if you have an unhealthy year, you might have more out-of-pocket expenses than you had in another year. That's the reality of retirement. And I guess now we'll bring in Jim. We're going to talk about how we deal with that variability, if you will, in real life compared to how we've made the projections within the minimum dignity floor expenses themselves. So long preamble. Now
I was going to say, I was just ready to point that out. My God, your intros are getting longer and longer and longer.
Well, you're picking these kind of complicated topics, and people, when we do these multi-show series, if someone plopped in and didn't listen to the last one, we got to give them a little.
I'm picking complicated topics as if retirement planning is easy and we could just choose easy topics.
Well, if someone asks you, you know, what's the RMD in 2023 for such and such a circumstance for an 83-year-old, that's pretty easy.
We got another complicated, can you help me? This is damn-ass confusing for the Q&A show. Want to guess on what?
Let me guess. RMDs in the Post-Secure Act
Post-Secure world. Post-Secure Act, another one. This one, this person at least admitted they didn't pay attention to the previous shows, and they wish they did. So that person, if you, I don't know if this is playing before the Q&A, I get confused. But if it is, you all know who you are. You know who you are, and I will answer your show on the Q&A. But, yeah, that is causing a whole host of confusion. So I don't think there's too much that's easy about retirement planning. Just my take. It's, if it was easy, I often say Chris and I wouldn't have a job.
Well, if you have so much money that you couldn't possibly run out, that does make things a little easier, at least less stressful.
True. Maybe I'm talking about for the easy, people we work with mostly. Yeah, if it was easy, we wouldn't have a job. But anyways, Chris did give a rather long but good intro to what we're going to talk about, where I left off. There's things that I want to get to. As is typical, folks, I come up with these ideas, and literally, there is no script. I don't write this out. I'm just going to yap for another hour on the minimum dignity floor. And if I cover everything between last week's show and this show that I think I want y'all to consider as you're projecting your own retirements, again, most of you are do-it-yourself, Vanguardian, Excel spreadsheet engineer type folks. I'm going to try to help you out by giving you what we do here. If we can get it all wrapped up today, great. If not, I'll continue next week. You know me. It's just I'm the guy who did five shows on QLEX. So I could easily do twice.
I was there too. Not willingly, but somebody had to push the record button.
Was it five or three?
It felt like 12, but I think it was five.
It was really five? Five shows on QX?
Well, that was before we started doing these marathon shows that you've gotten me going on now where they're 90 minutes instead of 60.
Hmm. Still, 5 hours of QLEX discussion. That's pretty damn good.
Good's a word.
Don't tempt me. I'll do it again.
Oh, goodness.
All righty. But anyways, where I left off last week, Chris calls it a teaser. It really wasn't a teaser. But what I just wanted people to know, and I'll just pick up right where we left off. By design, I kept saying by design, the minimum dignity floor.
I don't know if I'd call it by design. It's not our design. It's just life happens this way. Life is more variable than what projections might show because we can't predict the variability. We don't know when your car is going to break down. We don't know when your dishwasher is going to fail, needing replacement. We don't know when you're going to have, you know, some unexpected variable items happen. We just know it's likely they will happen, or at least, I don't know if likely to happen is the right way to describe it. I think it's more, we want to be prepared for them when they do happen. That's really the issue when we're trying to budget for something or build this foundation that is represented by the minimum dignity floor. So I don't know that our design is necessarily what is happening here. It's
okay.
We can't really make it look like reality since we don't know when these things are going to happen. So I think that's where you're headed.
I'm headed, and that's what I wanted people, because a lot of you do-it-yourselfers, especially the ex-engineers or current engineers, you spend your whole life making sure everything came out exact. Everything was right. Everything fit. They have to fit. You can't almost fit when you're an engineer. It has to be correct. The minimum dignity floor definitely has wiggle room in it, and it has to. Because you, or should I say, Chris, not necessarily the minimum dignity floor, the secure income used to cover the minimum dignity floor has a lot of wiggle room in it as well. And that's because, as Chris already mentioned, many expenses that we do put as part of your minimum dignity floor, or what I like to call the minimum life, or what I should have called the minimum lifestyle floor, a lot of those expenses vary. They're going to happen, but they don't happen every year. And when they do happen, you want to make sure the older you, that's who you're doing this for, folks. You're doing all of this for the older you. You want to make sure when the older you needs money, the money is there to cover a minimum dignity floor expense. That is a non-negotiable in our approach to retirement planning. We feel the younger you needs to make sure the older you will be able to take care of their minimum dignity floor, a minimum lifestyle. Variable expenses, the fun in life, that could theoretically be cut. In a perfect world, it won't. And we'll get into, we're going to do a series of shows as well on the fun number concept. But let's not get too deep into the fun today. When it comes to minimum dignity floor items, we want to make sure the money is there. But because the expenses vary, in any given year you may pay more or less on medical, which is a big part of the minimum dignity floor. I'm living proof of that. Between my stroke and ablation procedures, in they happened within months of each other, but the timing was one happened in one year, the other happened in the other year. For 2 years, I had very high out-of-pocket medical expenses after going many, many, many years with rather muted medical expenses. That's very typical. You can have an expense that comes out of the blue, whether it's medical, it could be in your home, especially with the replacement. I think we might have spoke about this last week. I can't remember. The replacement of durable good items. When you are 75, 80, 85, we want to make sure you can replace your refrigerator. That's not a variable expense. It's not a desired expense. It's a required expense. We want to make sure your refrigerator is covered and not, oh, well, I don't have the money. I can't replace the refrigerator or the washer or the dryer or the dishwasher or any other durable good item that you want. But you don't need them all the time. Even the autos, as Chris explained how he does his transportation expenses for one vehicle, not multiple. Multiple vehicles will be covered with fun. One vehicle at minimum is part of the minimum dignity floor. But a lot of those expenses associated with the vehicle don't happen all at once. And correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but the way we do it, and the way we get the data from AAA, part of every annual auto expense is also the cost of purchasing and replacing that vehicle at some point in the future. Do I have that part correct?
Yeah, and I believe I'm doing this from memory because I haven't read the specific fine prints in super recently, but I'm pretty sure AAA assumes replacing the vehicle every 7 years.
I believe it was seven. It was either five or seven, but my gut says
seven. It's longer than five. So I'm 90% sure it's every 7 years. And so they build that in, that 7 years kind of amortized or averaged out over that time period is going to cover the cost. And some people point out, well, I buy a used car and I drive it for a longer time or something. It turns out when we look at the numbers, a used car is going to cost less, but then it's going to be worth less at the end of, say, a 7 or 8 year period. So there's not a lot of residual value.
And may cost
value.
More to maintain.
Yep. And then, but if you buy a new car after 7 years, it still has maintained more of its value. So they factor that in, the trade-in value anticipated at that time. So they've done all this data research. So They kind of live and breathe this kind of stuff, so we find that their data is pretty reliable, pretty comprehensive. It takes into consideration really everything related to the ownership and operation of vehicles.
But follow the point I'm trying to make here, listeners. Clearly, you can understand, especially in the auto, it definitely shows in the auto, but it also shows in healthcare and durable good replacement, which we factor in as occurring every 10 years. It doesn't mean you're going to buy a new car every year or replace a washer every year. So we know they're going to happen over time. So in any given year, your actual minimum dignity floor expenses will vary widely from what you're projecting. Just get used to it. It's going to happen. It's called life. It's just going to happen that way. But because we are humans and we want to try to get some type of projections and start planning our lives, which is a wonderful thing to do. Even animals do it. The squirrels are running around my place like crazy now, gathering everything that they
can. Planning for retirement.
Yeah, planning for their retirement, well, otherwise known as winter. And, I mean, for a squirrel, that's a big thing. For a human, it's, hey, I'm going to go skiing. But for a squirrel, it's, wow, I wonder if I'm going to live. So they have to, you know, go out and gather and plan. So that's kind of what you're doing as you're trying to project your retirement. I just want you to know by design, it's going to vary. So what do we do about it? Well, the first thing, you have to accept it. That's what's going to be the simple truth of this. You have to accept the fact you are never going to be spot on. And I know for you engineer types, that's difficult. The second thing to do, it's one of the reasons we favor, especially if you need secure income, don't necessarily run out and try to buy it all at once. Don't look and say, well, in year one, I'm projecting I'm going to be short $10,000 and it grows from there. I must be short $10,000 every year. No, maybe one year you're short 10, another year 12, another year just 7. It's going to be that variable. So we sometimes recommend when you go to buy an income annuity, if you need one, that you do them in stages. And we'll talk about that, Chris, with some of the email questions we have. Mm-hmm. But I did want to address that part. But it's also another reason why we have a very simple approach. If you recognize in some years your minimum dignity floor expenses are going to be far higher than what you actually took in secure income, and in other years you will actually be taking in far more secure income than in actual expenses you'll experience, we have a way to address that. Do you want to give it away or do you want me to give it away?
Well, I'll describe it briefly and then let you take it because it's honestly, this was one of your ideas that came up from, you know, how do we manage for this kind of variability? Because what we don't want to have happen is in a year, for instance, so hopefully people understand what Jim's described here. Let's pretend we've kind of built our minimum dignity floor from the last show, that whole concept. Then we've addressed it by looking at secure income to, quote, cover it, but realizing that when we did our estimates for the minimum dignity floor, those expenses were on average every year, but we're going to have, in reality, years that are below or above that. But we have budgeted for them on average, which fits nicely with looking at income, which was usually predictable too. That's the whole point of secure income, is it's predictable and regular and coming in all the time. And let's say you've got Social Security and pension income that looks like it's going to cover the average of your minimum dignity floor. So that's a good start to our version of retirement planning. That's your foundation. But then we get into reality when your minimum dignity floor expenses vary because of what we mentioned, healthcare, transportation, durable goods replacements, you know, are going to vary from year to year. And what we don't want you to do, the fear is in a year where the minimum dignity floor expenses are below the secure income level, that seems like a bonus year. You've got, oh my gosh, look, we thought we'd spend $60,000 on minimum dignity floor. We only spent $48,000. So we've got $12,000 extra that we can blow on vacation. No, you can't. And the reason is that $12,000 extra that's left over really needs to be reserved for years in the future where you might go over your secure income and your minimum dignity floor, because maybe it's a year you buy a car or you have, you know, several replacements of your washer, dryer, whatever, those kinds of things. You have to be prepared for that. And so in order to clarify or to keep track of that and not let it get lost in some kind of mix where you accidentally spend these reserves that should be building up in lean spending years, on fun, which is what we, you know, blown it on vacation. Instead, we would propose that you consider what Jim calls a two checking account strategy. And this is elegant in its simplicity, is what I'll call it. The concept is And maybe you can give us some backstory as to how this started and how many people actually use this that you know of. But the whole idea is that you have a checking account where it receives all of your secure income. So your Social Security, pension, income annuity, if you have it, all flow into that checking account. And it's from that checking account you pay all your minimum dignity floor expenses. And oftentimes people will seed that account with a little bit of cushion just in case they have a heavy spending year early on, to get it kind of started, if you will. But then you should notice that that account will fluctuate in value over time, but it'll kind of refill and be able to absorb heavy spending years, but then it'll build up a little bit in years where it's leaner. And you kind of monitor that account. And if it gets excessively built up, like you just maybe overestimated your minimum dignity floor for a long period of time, you could make the conscious choice to scrape some of that money aside and say, you know, this is just way too much cushion now. Let's go have a splurge, you know, vacation or something like that at that point. But on a year-to-year basis, you're naturally going to let it build up or shrink down a bit as life happens. The second account is where you do all your spending for desired expenses. So you essentially take this concept of separating required and desired and build a checking account for each one of those, and that will keep them segregated so you can easily monitor what's going on with the minimum dignity floor, how much cushion you have in there, are you getting too low, those types of things. So that's the basics. Again, I used a gym level of words to describe the basics there, but Jim, why don't you tell us how you came up with this? Maybe give us some background and if you've, you know, feedback from people who have actually used it.
Well, it was mostly designed or thought of by necessity. I was having clients, this is years ago when I used to to actively do that part of the firm, meeting with clients on a regular basis. But back then, people would come in and they would often tell me, oh, well, we went and we did this, we went and we did that, we bought this. And I would say, well, where did you get the funding from? Oh, well, it was in our checking account. We didn't spend as much as we thought, and we went out and we bought these items. And it took me a while, but I eventually figured out what was happening is their accounts where their secure income was being deposited. Now, there are some instances, folks, where secure income is more than the minimum dignity floor expenses. And that extra dollars, those dollars above the minimum dignity floor, can go to fund and often do in our analysis. But there's a lot of instances where the minimum dignity floor is projected to be lower. And especially during the deferral period, which is one of the questions we recently got, during the deferral period, which is the period of time between retirement and usually when your Social Security is on.
That's what we call the delay period.
Delay period, not deferral period. I'm sorry, delay period. Especially during that time, I noticed, Chris, where we should have been taking withdrawals to replenish the shortages in minimum dignity floor spending, people weren't taking the withdrawals. And it's obvious what was happening. They weren't experiencing the big expenses yet. So their accounts were growing and they didn't necessarily need to withdraw as much or any. And then some people were spending it. And it's hard to tell someone, oh, you can't spend money on that because money is fungible. The IRS says that, tax court says that, and so do Chris and I. And I knew ultimately if they took the money from their quote-unquote minimum dignity floor checking account and not from the money that we have in cash over here in an account to cover fun, it can be made up because I still have that cash over here in fund that I could put for minimum dignity floor. So I knew and I get it and I acknowledge we could keep track of this. But what was happening a lot were people, clients, were having a difficult time keeping track of it as well, folks. Especially there's one client usually who's very involved, another who isn't. And it was hard for them to picture the dollars, to get an idea of how this would happen. Now, we had some clients who were very good, very astute with Quicken, which is an old program. I mean, I still have it, but gosh, that program goes back to the 90s. I'm sure some of you listening use Quicken. Do you use Quicken, Chris? I don't know.
I don't.
Okay. But a lot of people do, and I've been using it for years. So they could easily track every single dollar they had, dollars that they were spending. But other people were having difficulty. And when I was trying to explain to them, well, by design, your checking account should be rising because we take a lot of the expenses that happen occasionally and we're going to annualize them instead. I just thought, well, why don't we have two separate checking accounts? Some of our clients do this and love it. Other clients refuse to do it. They don't want multiple accounts. They're going to put it all in their base checking account and just try to track it that way. What we sometimes do, especially when required minimum distributions begin, is we can hook the or link the IRAs to their bank account. They're usually their checking account, and transfer money directly into that checking account when they need it. So if they were going to do a big purchase, they may say to us, hey, can you release $20,000 from my RMD? And we can transfer it in. They see the big purchase coming in, the big deposit coming in, and then they'll take that fund money out. But some people do have a hard time separating. They can't do the mental accounting. And they find having two accounts very easy. We put all secure income, Social Security, pension, and income annuity in the first checking account. If somebody has other sources of secure income or of income that they want to make part of their secure income, it may not reach or match Chris and I's definition of secure income, but they want us to dedicate it towards covering their minimum dignity floor so they don't have to go out and purchase an income annuity. Examples of that would be royalties or rental income. That can pay into that checking account as well. And they just kind of know that that checking account, Chris, is for anything that's not discretionary or fun. And granted, some parts of your minimum dignity floor are fun. I mean, getting a new car is fun, and that could be part of your minimum dignity floor, replacing your vehicle. But for the most part, they know if it's food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, I'm going to pay for it out of this checking account. And nowadays, a lot of people have bills paid automatically out of their accounts, and they set it up that way. They will have another account. Usually, not usually, but sometimes an online bank account that might be linked to another checking account. That way they get a little higher interest. And you can do the same thing with your minimum dignity floor checking account. Link it to an online bank account. And that way the money can be transferred quickly and easily right online in and out of the accounts. And what we will do, any discretionary withdrawals from their accounts, if they are pre-required minimum distribution, or if it's a brokerage account or a Roth account that doesn't have required minimum distributions, we will link it to their second checking account, if you will, or their online account. We'll link it to a separate account, is the aim, and transfer the discretionary distributions, the fun spending, folks. That's what this is all about, is helping you come up with your fun budget. By not mingling the two pools, even though we acknowledge all money is fungible, but by not mixing it in, it is easier for people to track their minimum dignity floor. It's easier for you to track to see if you're overestimating it. If that checking account is growing for your minimum dignity floor, is growing, and in some years or some periods of years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years perhaps, it will grow. But if it just continues to grow or is growing much larger than our software ever projected, then clearly you are not tracking your minimum dignity floor expenses accurately. There's an error somewhere. Let's look at it. Or maybe the secure income is a lot higher than we thought. Maybe some of this secure income can start being applied to fund spending. These are the reasons I came up with the two checking account strategy and what I'm trying to do. We don't require our clients to do it. It's just many have found it very easy and a smart, simple idea. Others have thought, no, that's silly. I don't want a second account. I want to consolidate, not get more accounts. I'll track this myself. But what we want you to know isn't necessarily to run out and do the two checking account strategy. What I want you do it yourselfers to know when you're crunching your numbers, you are never going to estimate every single year what you are going to spend on food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare to the point where you're going to be spot on. It's just never going to happen. There's too much variability. That's okay. I keep saying it's by design. It's by design of life, not by design of Chris and I. It's just the way life works. Some years you do more than you did the previous year. Other years you're going to do less. And because of that, your secure income is never going to be exact. But we want it to be a little bit higher than you normally need in any given year, not constantly lower where you're running a deficit. So it will be building up, especially because you don't buy a new car every year. You don't replace a washer every year. But every year, we're going to put that cash flow expense into your minimum dignity floor. So you're going to have that extra money. That is not extra money that can go to a trip or a new car or a fishing trip or a new hunting rifle like I just got. That is not what that money is designed for. That money is to cover a future washer or dryer or deductible on your home insurance because you had a hailstorm and you got to replace your roof, or your roof just aged and needs replacing. Whatever the case may be, that's when that money needs to be spent on. So we encourage it to be built up. Then you can transfer it into one of these online bank accounts, earn a little bit more interest. Or if it gets really big and you want to invest it, that's up to you, even though I wouldn't recommend that because I think the risk capacity of those dollars is low. But there's other things you can do with it if that minimum dignity floor reserve, for lack of a better term, gets too big in your opinion. So that's all we want to talk about when it comes to funding. But what I really want to dive into now, Chris, is why do we believe in funding the minimum dignity floor with lifetime secure income? I said on the first show, it's because minimum dignity floor expenses of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare continue forever, whether you have money or not. So we believe in covering it with income that will continue forever, whether you have money or not. But it goes deeper than that, folks. It goes to the point that as we age, what happens to us, Chris?
Well, we start to decline mentally in our ability to process all the complexities surrounding finances and life sometimes in general, and different people are going to decline at different rates. Certainly, this is a very personal thing, but you will decline over time. Hopefully, you'll decline so slow that you're sharp as a tack on the very last day, but that you can't assume that's going to happen. That's what the scoop is with planning for the future. You need to be prepared for it not to go perfectly. And so it's reasonable to assume you're going to decline over time. So when it comes to your basic finances, especially something as critical as covering your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, simplicity is wonderful. Simplicity. Those of you who are dealing yourselves, maybe that are listening, that are heading into retirement, but you have parents who are still alive, you've seen this, and they probably have overly complicated lives. Some are lucky enough to have simplified, and they're living, you know, the happy life and no stresses, etc. That should be the goal, to live that level of calm. Things are handled. No big decisions come up every single day to figure out how you're going to pay your utility bill. You know, those kinds of things which are controllable. Control what you can. There's going to be things you can't control that are going to come up that you have to be dealt with. But why not turn the complexity dial down to simple with the things you can control and that are so important?
Exactly. So this, to me, three main reasons why I like to fund the minimum dignity floor with secure income. And it's all designed to make your retirement pleasurable and easy. Chris hit the first one. As we age, we decline cognitively. You see that all around. I see that with my parents, even though neither one of them are in severe cognitive decline, especially my dad. He doesn't quite at 87 really understand finances much anymore. I mean, he understands money and he understands his Social Security check and when it comes in and how to go out and pay and buy things. But he doesn't follow the markets. He doesn't understand any of that. It's way beyond his comprehension now. If you are funding your retirement and your minimum dignity floor, which are expenses that happen all the time, if you are funding them with a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate from your assets, if you're always having to watch the markets and worry, well, how much should I have in cash? How should I cover this? Where's that money going to come from? It gets very confusing. It gets, as you age, it gets confusing, it gets complex, and it gets scary. And you're not going to want to do it, or you're going to make an irrational decision at some point because you're scared. And that is the worst time to make any decision, is out of fear or greed, which are two human emotions that drive us immensely. I've heard countless times people regretting making a decision when they were fearful and equally regretting a decision later when they were greedy. Because they usually, on the greedy side, Chris, took on way more risk than they should have, and now they're paying for it. And on the fear side, they were being way too conservative and then later regret it. Since minimum dignity floor goes forever, I wanted or feel passionately that as you age and your cognitive abilities to understand financial concepts declines, I talk all the time about the study from Harvard University that had to be come out now, Chris, 11, 12-ish years ago now. It's been a while.
There's been follow-up studies supporting it.
Exactly. But, but Harvard stated in their study, and I'm not saying they're right or wrong just because it's Harvard, but they found the human brain and the average person is always going to be the anomalies, the tail events, the black swans, whatever you want to call them, where some people never master financial concepts and other people never lose their ability to deal with it. We get that. But the vast majority of people are going to fall into the center of that bell curve. And for most people, the part of our brain that understands financial concepts reaches its peak at 53. And then from there, it begins to decline. It's not a cliff. Or if it was, Chris and I wouldn't be here right now doing this podcast. We'd be somewhere, probably sitting around going, blah, 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 but we wouldn't be doing this podcast. So it's not a cliff, obviously, but I'm not naive. I just read an article yesterday. Should financial advisors take cognitive exams? And it never answered the I'm paraphrasing the title if someone's going to Google it, but it's you can look for it, but it's not the exact title that I just said. But the point of the article was asking, should financial advisors be forced to make sure they're still giving good advice, that as they age, their ability to give good advice may decline? And the author never said yay or nay. I think they were just throwing it out there as food for thought. But it did get me wondering. But it's also part of the reason why I don't feel I'll be doing this, at least to the extent I'm doing it, in more than 10 years. Because I'll be ready to turn 70. Number one, after nearly dying 2 years ago, I want to make sure I can enjoy myself. But number two, I do worry, Chris. Will I be as sharp as I am now? Am I as sharp now as I was 10 years ago? I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't want to get to the point where I think I'm doing things right, but I'm not. That's a Texas Tech study that Chris is referencing, as well as other studies, that kind of supports the finding of Harvard, but takes it one step further. Texas Tech, when they did their study, confirmed Harvard, But when they looked at their data and when they came out with their findings, they found that our, I don't know if the word is ability or belief.
Confidence,
mm-hmm. right? It's our confidence level did not decline nearly as fast as our ability to understand financial concepts. Yep. So you kept thinking you were doing it right or thinking you knew what you were doing, but in reality, you didn't. You combine that with an inability to understand financial concepts, and it spells disaster. So I believed passionately in the minimum dignity floor. I told you how it dawned on me or came to me with the whole strawberries when I was a police officer. All of that happened. All of that is the truth. All of that formed my base. But when I had to sit there and say, okay, how am I going to cover this? That was knee deep into Monte Carlo software was just coming out. It was thought of to be infallible. It was the biggest, brightest, best thing. Everybody had to have it. That was coming out. The 4% rule was in no doubt at all, like it is now. And I didn't fall for any of that because I kept thinking, well, these are expenses that have to last forever. We are going to decline. I knew that. I knew that part. The confidence study hadn't come out yet, but the Harvard study did come out. But I also didn't like funding minimum dignity floor, which to me has to be covered. It's a non-negotiable, folks. What I didn't like about it, Chris, is you're always exposed to market risk. Even if you were one of the black swan tail event people and you never lost your ability to understand financial concepts, you are still going to be exposed to constant market risk. And this notion where you hear it to this day, Chris. Oh, well, if you have to, you can do what?
You can cut if you are exactly. Have unfortunate returns, we'll call them. You just react to that and cut your spending.
As mm-hmm. if you could magically cut food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care.
Right.
Technically, you could. You don't need strawberries in your retirement. But I want them. I didn't work my whole damn life to not have strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, you can't cut food totally, but the point is you could massage it. I understand that.
But not easily.
Yeah. You could turn your heat down in the winter and up the air conditioner up in the summer, the heat down in the winter, but do you want to? And that made no sense to me. That not only are you always going to be exposed to market risk, the answer was, well, you can cut expenses in years that the market doesn't perform as you hope. I don't buy that. I don't even like that. As far as fun goes, and we'll get into that when we do shows on our fun number, but you're going to hear Chris and I talking about fun as important as minimum dignity floor, because it is. It's the only life you're ever going to have. And when you retire and you go into your go-go phase, that's the phase where you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to do what you like. And that only has another 5, 8, 9, 10 years maybe left, and that's it. Not that you're going to die, you just might not be able to do it anymore. Or yes, worse, you could die. That's it. The idea, Chris, that you would even want to cut fun is horrendous to us, but I'm going down the wrong track. I'm going to get back onto minimum dignity floor. So when I came up with covering it with lifetime secure income, it was because I wanted to protect you from aging. I wanted to protect you from market risk. And I wanted to protect you from something else. And a lot of you listeners are going to say, that's me, meaning you, not me. Or a lot of you spouses who are being forced to listen to this, even though you don't want to, you might smack the person upside the head and say, yep, that's you. I wanted to help you overcome the emotional risk of spending your own damn money once you retire on fun. Not necessarily just on minimum dignity floor. You have no choice but to take care of your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. Well, it comes back to what I call the bottomless cup of coffee. It's a wonderful way to describe secure income. I always figured, if you actually break it down, Chris, and I don't know if you ever crunched the numbers or if you want to do it anecdotally, what percent of retirement expenses do you think the minimum dignity floor represents?
Are you talking overall or?
Overall. Especially early in retirement, but overall.
Well, it varies. I've seen it everywhere from the minimum dignity floor being 70 plus percent of the total expenses to being not too many or over half. But I've seen it being.
I was
going
to say
half.
60 to 70. That's what I used to project it at. Mm-hmm. So Chris and I you guys know, and Chris, God bless you, you deal with me. I throw these things at you out of the blue. There is no telling him ahead of time, this is what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, because Jim doesn't even know.
I don't even, literally. I mean, seriously, folks.
He'd tell me if he knew.
I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I kid you not. And if you saw the desk I'm on right now, there's papers, there's a couple of tissues, there's a two packets of paper clips. I have no idea why.
It's kind of like an X-ray vision into your mind.
Literally, this desk is my mind because there's just crap everywhere. I didn't come into this expecting I'm going to talk about this, that, and the other thing. I'm just trying to relay to you concepts I want you to consider. And when I designed the concept of the minimum dignity floor, I told you how the elderly woman, I bought her the strawberries and it got me to thinking. But then I had to spend a lot of time, years, trying to come up with how am I going to fund this? And when I read the Harvard study, I just kept thinking and just dealt with people and you watched older people, especially I grew up in the 80s and I watched Ronald Reagan. Some argue he went into office with it. And it took, what, less than a year after he left office to finally announce that he does have Alzheimer's. I saw that. I grew up with that. I understood. My Uncle Benny had it for 12 years. And I always point out, because I like to let people know, my Uncle Benny was not my uncle. We called him Uncle Benny. He was my father's first cousin. So that just makes him like really close family member to me. But we always called him Uncle Benny. He had it. So I knew that this could happen, the aging. I never liked covering expenses that have to be covered with market risk and then be told, well, cut it if you can't. And I used to think, well, that's stupid. How am I going to cut those? But also, when I wanted to be a retirement planner, it was to help people spend comfortably on fun, because that's what a lot of people relate to us, Chris, in the early years. They couldn't get over that mental block of spending their money. Well, if you knew 60 to 70% of your expenses that cannot be cut, if you want to maintain your lifestyle, the whole point of retirement isn't to cut the lifestyle you grew up with in your working years. It was to maintain it. If you knew, though, folks, that money never ran out, like the bottomless cup of coffee at the breakfast joint down the street that you might go to on a Saturday or Sunday morning, or if you're retired on any morning of the week you want. When that bottomless cup of coffee is there, you don't care if the coffee spills, you don't care if it gets cold, you don't care if you guzzle it down. The waitress is going to come and fill it right back again. If you knew your minimum dignity floor is going to be covered with lifetime guaranteed income, you will have no problem spending that minimum dignity floor checking account on those expenses. So if you knew all your other assets just need to go to fun, now we skipped a whole series of steps between funding the minimum dignity floor and your fun number. We'll get into that on future shows. But if you knew that fun money that you have, when you figure out your fun number, that money is not needed for food, utilities, transportation, housing, health care, a buffer, a guaranteed inheritance, and your aging and LTC expenses, because all of those were covered, I just felt you would emotionally feel better spending on fun. So the minimum dignity floor and secure income is part of the way, not only to give you the clarity and the forethought and the understanding that this is what your fund budget is, it goes to helping that, it gives you that knowledge, that surety that this money never can be outlived. I am always going to be able to take care of the minimum dignity floor. And of course, if you monitor the other items that make that up, the aging, the guaranteed inheritance, if that's important, and the buffer, you monitor those, you'll feel more comfortable spending on fun. Mm-hmm. So that's the other reason, Chris, I believe in covering it with secure income. Why we believe in isolating those expenses, projecting them for their own appropriate inflationary rates, and covering them with Social Security, pension, and income annuity.
Yeah, and that's a key differentiator versus those advisors or planners out there that are giving you this confidence level out of a Monte Carlo assessment. They can, we found in practice, you can show people all day long that they've got a 90%+ success rate, likely, by using some type of reasonable withdrawal rate. And so many of them still have trouble bringing themselves to spend money in the early years because they're still worried that it's not going to work out somehow. And preaching the confidence level over and over and over again, for many people, doesn't work. For some people, it does. And there's plenty of people out there doing successful planning using that approach. So it's not, I'm not describing it as if you're doomed if you're following that approach by any means. But we find that this approach deals with that emotional piece a lot more effectively. And people, I can just, you know, we do most of our presentations remotely. All I can hear is the audio, but I can tell you when we go through these types of things, I show them minimum dignity floor. Hey, looks like you're in good shape. The secure income you have looks to protect it nicely. The rest of the money, you know, you have these priorities, but look, this pool can be spent. They, you can just hear the relaxation in their voice when they realize all that's covered and dealt with in a way that they don't have to worry about outliving the money. That's what the secure income piece does for you. And then they start to feel more free with their spending. It's an amazing emotional reaction. And I think that should be everyone's goal, is to get themselves to both a financial stability and emotional stability to spend confidently in the go-go years, which we harp on constantly, is a limited period of time. We don't know how long it's going to last. You got to take advantage of it. And restricting your spending because you're fearful of what's going to happen at 90, that's really doing your 65-year-old selves a disservice, or your 70-year-old selves. When you're still young enough to go out and do things, you've got to be able to find a way to spend, whether it's, you know, just simply with the financial justification of doing so, but more often than not, you've got to combine it with the emotional confidence that you can do it. And this, if there's a better way to provide that emotional step, we're all ears. We'll consider incorporating it, but I haven't seen a more effective method of approaching this than what we use, you know, just to toot our own horns a little.
Toot our own horns. So tout, it's tout, not toot.
It's toot.
It's tout, tout, tout your own horn.
That's, well, in Jim's world, it's tout. We can do whatever. We're going to toot and tout our horns both.
I've in always a celebration. Said, I've always said tout, tout your horn.
I know you have.
Oh. All right. Well, anyways, folks, I like tout, and those of you from Massachusetts probably tout as well. Because that's what we do as mass holes. That's the best saying of all from people in Massachusetts. New Englanders call Massachusetts people mass holes. I just love that.
Hey, this is a family show.
I said mass hole. Okay, we only got a few more minutes that I want to spend on this. Mm-hmm. And we got three questions in. And even though they're from three different people, they sound different, they're all really about the same thing. Hmm. How do you fund the minimum dignity floor? Well, Chris and I believe in covering it with what we call secure income. And I think we need a definition of that, because one of our questions kind of deals with that directly. This definition I came up with, it's mine. It's not in any textbook. Half a dozen advisors could listen to this and think I'm an idiot, and the other half a dozen say, hey, that's a pretty smart definition, Jim. It's more of the art than the science part. But when I was working on this and trying to come up with my whole theory and approach to retirement, I thought to myself, well, what is secure income? How am I going to know what it is? I could see all these different types of income. There's dividend, there's interest, there's bond, there's withdrawal rates, which technically isn't a source of income. There's part-time labor, there's royalties. There's all these different types. There's rental. What is secure income? There's Social Security, there's pension, there's annuities. So I thought to myself, it has to have a few elements. If it has all three elements, it's secure income. If it doesn't have all three, it's not secure income. But Chris will explain in a minute, we don't ignore it before buying an income annuity. That is key. Because an income annuity, you are going to be loath to buy it. I get that, especially you listeners who are in your 50s and even early 60s. You engineer Vanguardian do-it-yourselfers who have been taught index investing, passive, low cost, and hate annuities. I get all that. But it's not your decision to make. It is going to be the decision of the older you. Usually 78 to 83 is that 5-year period is where most people will need to purchase their first annuity or consider purchasing their first annuity. It is not the decision of the 55, 60, 65-year-old. It's going to be the decision of probably the 78 to 83-year-old. The younger you, it's going to be your responsibility to make sure the older you has the money. It hasn't been spent on fun. It's been invested appropriately. It's been reserved. It's there. But it's a decision the older you is going to make. But that doesn't mean we want even the older you, when the time comes, to go out and buy an income annuity if there's other sources of income. Chris will explain in a minute, once I describe what secure income is, when he's doing a plan, he will actually include other sources of income if it's substantial enough in size. That doesn't meet our definition by telling them a simple fact. And that is, you can buy an income annuity at any time, and the longer you wait, the cheaper it's going to be. So we have no trouble with you waiting. Let's use this other non-secure income as well. And he'll explain a little bit more about that. So to me, I have three simple parts to a definition. If income satisfies these three, it has to have all three. If it satisfies all three, to me, it's secure income, and it can be earmarked for minimum dignity floor. First, it's predetermined and known. There's no ambiguity. That seems fairly straightforward, but there were some annuity products years ago. You had no idea what the heck you were going to get out of it. It was impossible to project. There was no way to know. The income you're going to get every single year should be predetermined and known. It's going to be no less than this. Period. It's predetermined and known. There's no ambiguity. Second, remember I said you picked up on it, no quote unquote less than this. Second, the income, if it moves at all, can only move up, never down. I call that the ratchet effect. Those of you who know a ratchet set, it can only move in one direction. Now, you can control the direction it moves, yes, by flicking the little switch. But depending on which way you flick that switch, if it's only going to move to the left, it'll never move to the right. Or if it's only moving to the right, it'll never move to the left. Just like a ratchet, secure income only goes up, never down, if it moves at all. So it's predetermined and known. If it moves at all, it can only move up, never down. And the third element, the assets are not backed by you.
The income.
Excuse me, the income. is not backed by you. It's backed by a deep-pocketed third party. That is a lot of words to simply say the income is risk pooled. There are millions of other people pooling their dollars with you, and all of you are helping each other. That's the essence of insurance. Social Security is often called social insurance. You hear that often bantered about in especially older writings about Social Security. Social insurance. All of them, Social Security, pensions, and income annuities, are backed by deep-pocketed third parties, the U.S. government, a highly rated insurance company, or hopefully a very strongly rated or well-financed, is a better way of putting it, pension plan. So they're backed by a deep-pocketed third party, and it pools from thousands in the case of a pension to millions in the case of Social Security to maybe a couple of hundred thousand in the case of annuities. But there's far more people pooling together than you being that one zebra out on the Serengeti by yourself, an analogy that I've used in the past. So that's my definition of secure income. Chris, why don't you explain why we sometimes use non-secure income if they have it?
Well, there is some, I call it secure-ish or almost secure income that is quite predictable and stable, and it might meet those characteristics for the most part. Predictable, known, doesn't go down, typically only goes up. And I would call it, you know, maybe income that has the definition of almost always does these things, but sometimes might not. Could be treated as an income source to cover minimum dignity floor. The classic example that we see fairly frequently, because we have retirees that go into retirement that have rental properties, they've got rental income. Rental income coming in is not secure income, technically. It can stop. You can lose your renter. You can rents can go down sometimes instead of going up. They predominantly go up over time, but when people have such a thing, we oftentimes will treat it as a viable source of funding minimum dignity floor if we, through question and answer with the clients, determine that it is pretty reliable. It's pretty reasonable to rely upon it if it's in an area that is in high demand and has been historically. So rents should be stable, should be easy to find. Maybe they're currently renting it at below market rates, which means they could turn around and replace a renter very easily at the current rate. They're not already at the top of the market where they could suffer a decline if they had to replace a renter or lost one. All those types of things become part of the conversation we don't need to have with, say, a pension estimate or an income annuity. We kind of know those things, and we don't have these variables that could be in there. But the biggest thing that backs rental income, as my first example here, that makes it justifiable to use as a relatively secure income source for purposes of funding the minimum dignity floor, is if the asset behind that rent is owned free and clear. In other words, if the rent started to become unpredictable, you actually have something of value behind it that could be, in essence, liquidated in order to generate other types of income to replace the rental income that you can't now rely upon. If all those things happen, you know, kind of this is kind of a holistic approach. You assess the income. Other people might have royalties or other forms of income, maybe some farm income I've seen at times that have been very, very predictable. And again, there's an asset maybe behind it that could be liquidated if something disrupts the income itself. Those things can often legitimately be used as a reasonable income source. But I think you should prepare for the what if it gets lost kind of a scenario and assess if you'd be in a really horrible position if you counted on that and because it wasn't technically secure income, it went away. What doesn't qualify in our world is dividend income. dividend income. For a lot of people, they see it coming in regularly. Maybe they built their whole portfolio in order to have dividend income as an income source in retirement. And maybe that is pretty darn reliable. It doesn't meet our secure income definition because it could go down. Businesses stop paying dividends. They reduce dividends. Some would argue, if I'm going to put both sides out there, that, oh, if the stock stops paying dividends, I'll sell it and buy something else. Well, usually when a stock pays a dividend and then stops, its value has declined substantially because lots of people came to trust that it was going to pay the dividend, and ceasing a dividend is a negative signal for company valuations most of the time. And so it's just not, you know, kind of forces you to sell something that's depressed. So you start playing this game, is the asset base underneath it substantial enough that it could absorb and adjust for these things? And you're going to have to manage and worry about these things moving on. That's kind of violating that principle that Jim mentioned before, where you want it simple going out there. In your 60s, maybe rebalancing your dividend portfolio is a piece of cake. 70s and 80s, 90s, is that really what you want to be worried about doing to make sure you have enough income coming in? So things like dividend income does not meet our secure income standard. I'm not saying that you are doomed to failure if you use dividend income as an income source to rely on in retirement. Many people have a substantial enough account filled with dividend paying investments that they are in a good position. Maybe they never ever have to touch the capital, the principal behind it. They have more dividend income they can ever spend. If you have that, this kind of falls into that category of retirement becomes much simpler to deal with. If you have so many assets, you can't possibly outlive them. If you leave your hands off of the principal of your investment, that's restricting for most people that are listening to this show. That's going to restrict your fund number extensively if you have to promise yourself to leave that untouched. So that's why those and a lot of reasons, dividend income is not considered a secure income source for us, no matter how predictable you think you've built your portfolio to be in regards to generating dividend income. Those are a few examples of how we might look at other sources of income and how they might or might not count as a reasonable source to rely on to fund your minimum dignity floor. Jim might have other examples he wants to bring up.
That's a couple. Those are perfect. And as we wrap up, because we're running long and it's getting close to quitting time for us, so next time we chat, I'm going to do a whole series of questions specifically to the MDF and secure income. So if anybody has any, Chris will explain to you at the end of the show how to get them to me. The only thing that I want to wrap up then, I think, Chris, to kind of tie this all together, the minimum dignity floor, the concept behind it, the expenses it covers, and funding it with secure income is all designed to keep your retirement simple. You always have to cover those minimum dignity floor expenses. The older you is going to want them covered. They want that implicit guarantee from you. Before you go spend one red cent on discretionary fun things, before you stop working at that job that you're so fed up with and you can't do another 2, 3, 4, 5 years, before you stop working, they being the older you, just wants to know they're going to be taken care of. They will not be that woman who couldn't afford strawberries 30 plus years ago that I had to help out that day in Massachusetts when I was working as a cop. That's the whole concept behind the minimum dignity floor and covering it with secure income. It is not a concept designed to sell annuities. I hate that. There are some advisors or insurance people or both out there that try to scare you into buying annuities. Chris and I think you had just started working for me. I'm not sure. Remember we helped someone, a Fed employee down in Denver who had a quote-unquote financial plan, which was 5 pages of annuities that this person should buy, and they had this incredible
massive pension.
And they wanted her to annuitize her TSP plan. Mm-hmm. Both you and I were just so thoroughly appalled by that. And we are not throwing every advisor under the bus on that by any stretch. There are far more good advisors than bad advisors. Minimum dignity floor and funding it with secure income is to first look at Social Security in a new light. Look at your pension before you knee-jerk reaction into the lump sum payout. Think long and hard on it. It might be wise to take it as a pension. The older you is going to love the simplicity, security of secure income. And then, of course, an income annuity, which we have no problem recommending, especially the purest single premium immediate annuities. Pure, simple, straightforward. None of these crazy annuities that they have out there now that we don't have to get into, but they're just so complex and difficult to understand. None of those. Just a simple income annuity. Just remember this, all you 50, 60-year-old engineers. The decision to buy that annuity is not yours. Don't let your biases cloud your judgment. Just make sure the older you has enough money in your projections to see where the minimum dignity floor is going to start to exceed whatever secure income you have, how long you project that shortage to occur, and just figure out how much money the older you is going to need and let them make the decision. Mm-hmm. It's part of the reason Chris and I try to talk people out of buying a deferred income annuity. Believe it or not, you do-it-yourselfers. Every now and then we run into people, and it's not as uncommon as you would think, who want to remove that risk right away, even now, and buy a deferred income annuity to say, hey, I know I'm going to need at least X amount of dollars. This insurance company today told me if I give them X amount of hundreds of thousands, it'll definitely be in the hundreds of thousands. If I give them X amount of hundreds of thousands, they'll guarantee me that money in the future. We don't necessarily recommend that at all, for a variety of reasons that we've explained time and time again on the show, least of which being you don't know what's going to happen over the next 8, 10, 12, 15 years while you're waiting for that income. Don't make an irrevocable decision, which a deferred annuity is. Don't make that irrevocable decision to change your mind later. Just make sure the money is there. We like people to fund their retirement with secure income. Not everybody has enough. I'm just imploring you to look openly, an open mind, at a simple, single premium, immediate annuity at some point in the future. Don't let your anti-annuity biases cloud your judgment today. That bias probably saved you a lot of money if you ever ran across a broker or a registered rep in the past who wanted you to buy a very expensive, high-fee variable annuity. You dodged that bullet. Although some of the older ones had really good income benefits, but outside of that, you dodged that bullet. But don't force the older you, who is not going to be as sharp as the younger you, who's going to have different emotions, different feelings, different priorities than the current you. Don't force them into that category as well of no annuity. Just reserve the money if there's a shortage and let the older you, 8, 10, 12 years from now, decide. And the older you may not be here. So 8, 10, 12 years from now, it's a moot point. But if they are there and there's still a shortage and they still have very good life expectancy chances, perhaps the older you would be receptive to purchasing the income annuity. And Chris and I don't force this upon anyone, and we don't want you to force it upon yourself. The decision to buy an income annuity to me is a personal decision, but it's one that the older you should make. So anyways, it's the reason I mention it is income annuities play a big role in our theory, but they don't play a big role in our practice. because we go to great lengths to not have people purchase annuities until they need it. And to us, most people need them between 78 and 83. That's an income annuity. MYGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities for principal protection, they play a pretty big role in our practice, especially the fee-based ones that don't charge our clients anything, and we use them as a fixed income substitute in asset management, not in funding their minimum dignity floor. So anyways, I just kind of want to end with that. We got a lot of good questions. We got three this week, and I have, I think, about eight from previous weeks. So the next show is going to be an EDU, but it's going to be dedicated, Chris, to all these questions on the minimum dignity floor, secure income, funding it. How do we look at different things? We got some good questions in, and I think people will enjoy that show.
Okay, that sounds good. So thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to send in your own questions this upcoming week in order to make it onto the EDU show, where we're going to focus on questions related to the MDF and secure income, best way to do that, send an email to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And in the subject line, make sure you make it clear it's for the MDF podcast. Maybe that's probably catches attention as much as anything. And you can also go to our website and submit, but I think it's better if you just email him directly if you want to make it onto this series and be part of our focus on the minimum dignity floor secure income concepts. Have a good evening, Jim. I'll let you go. And everyone, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the probably final, we'll see if we can get through all the questions, probably final show on this series, and then we'll dive into something else after that. But depending on the number of questions, it might take two shows. We'll just have to see. This is a hot topic with listeners. We talk about it so much, and it's unique pretty much to us, although I've seen variations of it out there. But this gets the juices flowing as far as people considering how to handle their own retirement. So we would love to have your questions, because if you have the question, it's most likely a bunch of other people do too. So send those on in, and we'll focus on those next week. We'll be back at same time, you know, same bat time, same bat channel.
You're having a hard time signing off. It's taking as long to sign off as it did to sign on.
I'm kind of drooling on here.
I know. It's like, my God, we just ended. I want to drive home.
Okay. You can go now. Everyone else can too.
Thank you.
See you later.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.